You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, which features Harry and Meghan on the cover. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. With a photograph by Mark Seliger, here's this month's editor's letter from Editor-in-Chief Radhika Jones. 5 years ago this January, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle announced they would be stepping back from royal duties, a decision that would lead to an even sharper break with their English family than the couple perhaps had anticipated, and ended with their relocation to California. Once there, they sat down with Oprah, as celebrities do, and told a lot, if not all. Then they set about charting a path to stateside financial and cultural power. But manifest destiny can be harder to pull off than it looks. Anna Peel, whose last story in the magazine probed the off-screen subculture of the Real Housewives, examines the Sussexes' life as Americans, from their media deals and charitable causes to the state of their union. In a modern world where tech bros, finance bros, and former reality TV stars hold ultimate sway, how do an actual duke and duchess, whose ties to royalty are at once their biggest draw and their bete noire, stay relevant? Can it be accomplished with podcast and jam? I read the first draft of Evgenia Peretz's story about an alleged sexual predator at Miss Hall's school with a sick feeling born of familiarity. The charismatic teacher targeting schoolgirls by taking advantage of their youthful insecurities. We have seen this play before. But what stood out about this case was the longevity of the alleged abuse, perpetrated by the same man over decades, and the astonishing failure on the part of faculty and administration members not only to heed what survivors say were repeated warnings about their star history teacher, but to step in and protect the girls entrusted to their care. Ironically, the solidarity now formed among Matt Rutledge's accusers feels like a twisted version of precisely the community a girls' boarding school is supposed to encourage. This article came about when, after one of them had filed a complaint with the school to little avail, Melissa Fairs and Hillary Simon reached out to Vanity Fair and got in touch with Evgenia, a trusted reporter with a track record of holding individuals and institutions accountable for such betrayals. Evgenia's many profiles and investigative pieces for Vanity Fair since she began contributing to the magazine in 1999 demonstrate both her gift for empathy and her ability to unravel deceit. You can stream Anatomy of Lies, the docuseries based on another of her Vanity Fair stories about shattered vulnerability, which she co-directed, on Peacock. Though it is painful to absorb what the students of Miss Hall's and their families endured and still wrestle with, it is an act of humanity to acknowledge their experiences and their quest for resolution. Melissa says, "The shame I feel is also his shame." And that's what predators, I think, do. They take their shame, they put it on you, and you have to carry it. Nothing can reverse what happened to these women, but we hope that stories like Evgenia's can play a role in putting the shame back where it belongs. Now for some of the contributors to this issue. Celia Azoulay, Red Hot, stylist, fashion editor, and consultant Azoulay, takes inspiration from 1970s Paris and the edgy contemporary street style of New York City. She described working with Natasha Lyonne as akin to the actor's signature hair, intense, energetic, and playful. Karine Jean-Pierre, behind the podium. For the past 4 years, I have spoken for the president. With this piece, I wanted to speak for myself and remind folks there is often more going on behind the camera than most people know, says Jean-Pierre, the first black openly queer immigrant to hold the role of White House press secretary. Evgenia Peretz, Girls Interrupted. Contributing editor Peretz says getting to know the sexual assault survivors of Matt Rutledge, a teacher at Miss Hall School, brought into sharp view the emotional fragility of girlhood. Peretz's 2022 article on TV writer Elizabeth Finch was recently adapted into the Peacock docuseries Anatomy of Lies. Camilla Akrens, Red Hot. Swedish photographer Akrens called her photo shoot with Natasha Lyonne a whirlwind of energy and excitement. Akrens is currently at work on a book inspired by enchanting Nordic summer nights. Kim Thompson, The Californians. Thompson is a UK-based illustrator and painter whose work explores oral histories and personal narratives. Her first solo portraiture collection, Water into Wine, debuted at New Art Exchange Gallery in Nottingham in 2024. Dirk Smilly, Atlas Shrugged. Everyone has a hidden life. This one was lived by one of the biggest influencers on Wall Street, says Smilly of the late Guggenheim Partners CIO Scott Menard. Smilly, a veteran journalist is the author, most recently, of The Business of Tomorrow, The Visionary Life of Harry Guggenheim, published by Pegasus. Bridget Jones isn't the only one who's mad about Leo Woodall by Savannah Walsh, with photographs by Nick Riley Bentham. Leo Woodall was worried. He was starting to doubt his ability to play a particularly tricky role. Jack, a stealth gigolo, posing as an older gay expat's nephew in the second season of HBO's latest water cooler hit. Then he remembered his acting teacher's mantra, "Take the safety belt off," Woodolph says. Mimicking the strap's removal, "You're on White Lotus. You've got this part where you can get away with doing anything, so just go to set and F it up." I decided to be braver. Since breaking out on the White Lotus, Woodall's been given plenty more opportunities to court danger. He starred in Netflix's One Day, a bruising love story based on David Nichols' bestseller, then signed on to play an emotionally stunted math genius in the Apple TV Plus series Prime Target, debuting January 22nd. Weeks later, Peacock will premiere Bridget Jones' Mad About the Boy, featuring Woodall as a potential new love interest for Renee Zellweger's heroine. Roles opposite other Oscar winners like Dustin Hoffman and Russell Crowe will follow. "It's been a mad year working with these big dogs," the 28-year-old London native says during a break from shooting a crime thriller called Tuner, as in piano tuner, not the fish. There are other actors in his family who have helped him navigate the industry, but they weren't able to prepare me to work with the likes of Dustin or Russell. Woodall had long loved film, but never aspired to be on screen himself until age 19, after seeing Jack O'Connell's electric performance on the late aughts teen soap Skins. Could the younger version of himself envision building a career of this caliber? "F no," Woodall says. "It's unbelievable how lucky I am." In this industry, the word luck is treated like a dirty word, but I take it, pocket it, and work as hard as I possibly can. Since The White Lotus, Woodall has also had to fight for work-life balance. "Doing One Day, I didn't really have a personal life. I knew that I wanted to make that easier on myself in the future," he says. More recently, he seems to have found the time. He logs into Zoom from a device called Megan's iPad. That would be Megan Fahey, his former White Lotus co-star and now girlfriend. "I've become very aware nowadays of how a person can feel overexposed in your private life," says Woodall, "and it's not that fun." He had a much better time joining the Bridget Jones universe for its fourth and final installment. "Franchises aren't always extended for the right reasons," says Woodall, "but this one, as people will see, definitely wraps things up very beautifully." Acting opposite Zellweger, whom he calls the warmest person in the world, Woodall focused on supporting his leading lady. "She's carrying this whole thing on her back, so I wanted part of my job to be serving whatever she needs." Although his eco-friendly character, Rockster, meets Bridget after the death of her husband, Colin Firth's Mark Darcy, Woodall felt no pressure to fill that character's shoes. "I was occupying a new space in her life," he says, "so I didn't feel like I was replacing him." Woodall has yet to meet either Firth, who is not credited in the fourth movie, or Hugh Grant, who reprises his role as Mark's former romantic rival, Daniel Cleaver. "I don't share scenes with him," Woodall confirms. "It's very sad." Grant has spoken candidly about his days in the rom-com trenches, sentiments that resonate with Woodall. "There's definitely pressure being the leading man, pressures you don't want to think about as a performer," he says. "Scripted things about characters that can make you look inward, even if it's just, he's the most handsome man in the world, like, oh, I'm not." Yet the idea of becoming the next Grant-esque romantic lead suits Woodall just fine. "Hey, I don't know how old Hugh is, but if I'm his age and have had the career that he's had, I will be a very happy man." Now here's what's trending. Sonic Boom. London's vibrant 80s club scene comes to life in Outlaws, which spotlights performance artist Lee Bowery's fashionable influence and all the glitter and hairspray that came with it. In the photo, Hilda Smith and Caroline Houghton in a photograph by Pete Moss, featured in Outlaws, published by Scala. Renegading, Louis Vuitton men's jacket, Gucci shoes, Charles Jeffrey Loverboy hat, J.W. Anderson sweater, Prada bag, Jennifer Bayer necklace, Connor Ives shorts, Mutha serum, Zankov top, Victoria Beckham beauty eyeliner, Chopovaloina dress, Selimi Optik and June Ambrose sunglasses, Marine Serre pants, Noise, 12 o'clock eau de parfum, all-in boots, and Amadeo earrings. Arty people at LACMA's 13th annual Art and Film Gala, presented by Gucci, the museum seemed to host half of Hollywood and raised more than $6.4 million. In the photos, Laura Dern, Sarah Paulson, Kaya Gerber and Ricky Martin, Simone Lee, Gucci creative director Sabato De Sarno, and Isa Gonzalez, John David Washington and Malcolm Washington, Charlie XCX, Kim Kardashian and Chloe Sevigny, Ellis Ahn, Mikey Madison. Photographs by Roger Kisby. And this from Daisy Shaw Ellis, all tied up, with photograph by Adam Friedlander. Valentino's fresh aesthetic under creative director Alessandro Michel is anything but simple. Mad Magpie, as the New York Times heralded his maximalist point of view. Take this burgundy jacquard necktie from Michel's surprise 171-look resort collection, styled with tie-pins fashioned after women's hair barrettes. The layered richness bends gender norms and embraces a dandyism adored by the designer's fervent fans. Frivolous or not, it's undeniably fabulous. Cinema Verite. At Art Basel Paris, Miu Miu reaffirms its support of women in film by Anne Binlow, with photograph by Brigitte Lacombe. On the eve of Art Basel Paris, around 80 performers dressed in Miu Miu fill the Palais d'Elena, the expansive Art Deco building currently home to the French Economic, Social, and Environmental Council. And they're pictured here. And each Paris Fashion Week, the brand's prêt-à-porter shows, this time, though, the actors and models were there for Tales and Tellers, an immersive exhibition celebrating women in film. For the exposition, Miuccia Prada tasked Museo d'Art Contemporain de Barcelona director Elvira Jangjeni-Oz and Polish multidisciplinary artist Gośka Maszuga with creating performance pieces and conversation panels inspired by 28 short films from Miu Miu's Women's Tale series. The initiative, which launched in 2011, gives female directors. Past participants include Jansiza Bravo, Haifa Al-Mansour, Miranda July, Chloe Sevigny, and Ava DuVernay, free rein to create short films with costumes by Miu Miu, which then premiere during industry events like New York Fashion Week. I am interested by the notion of bringing different conversations into the world of fashion, of engaging with different creative spheres, enriching each other, Prada told Vanity Fair. It mirrors the exchanges and communications of life. This project is another expansion, shifting between different mediums, and always exploring deep and fundamental thoughts of what it means to be a woman today. The support of Prada and Miu Miu, the Art Basel Public Program's official partner, remains alarmingly necessary. A 2024 report, Inclusion in the Director's Chair, found a striking lack of women directors in Hollywood. Out of 116 directors surveyed in 2023, only 12% were women. DuVernay understands these challenges firsthand. After she premiered her film, Middle of Nowhere, at the Sundance Film Festival in 2012, I thought that I would have offers, films, that people would want to work with me in the industry. And none of that happened, she said. Soon after, she directed The Door, 2013, as part of Women's Tales. All I heard was, "We'll give you a budget to make a movie," she recalled. That was a hugely transformative moment for me, at a time when traditional Hollywood was not inviting me to make things, that this fashion house saw something in my work and wanted to offer me that. Keziah Weir writes, On Books, Varsity Letters, a fanciful book makes the case for the lost art of correspondence. In the picture, male artist Ray Johnson's untitled Dear Blank, 1970. In 1956, the editor William Maxwell was having some trouble with beetles in his roses. When I come on the shreds of one that was exquisite in the morning and rattled by noon, he wrote to one of his authors, Eudora Welty, I have murder in my heart. Is there anything quite as intimate as receiving a good letter or reading someone else's? And yet, it's an endangered pleasure in our era of the ephemeral phone call, the thrown-off text. New Yorker writer Rachel Syme was in the stir-crazy early months of the pandemic, scribbling notes to friends and family when she put out an open call on social media. Was anyone interested in a pen pal? Yes, some 15,000 people. 4 years later, when we speak, Syme's ring finger is stained lamy turquoise. The splotch, a product of one of her prized fountain pens, the Pilot Custom 823, and she has just received a package of macarons from one of her correspondents, this one in France. The modern world doesn't have a lot of time for this kind of thing, so I'm doing it as a willful anachronism. She's captured the joy of letter writing and receiving, and hopes to spread the gospel. In Syme's Letter Writer, published by Clarkson Potter, the book, illustrated by Joanna Avilés, is a tongue-in-cheek riff on Frost's original letter writer, a stringent 1867 guide to proper correspondence. Accordingly, it contains such how-tos as describing the weather with style. We may be in the season of hibernal and rime, but on the horizon fecund petrichor bloom. The art of the postcard and finding pen pal programs from Last Prisoner Project to Letters Against Depression. In our increasingly online lives, amid a crisis of loneliness and polarization, sending a note is a refreshingly lo-fi act of connection. It's not the worst thing you can do with an extra hour, Syme writes. It might make someone's week, or month, or year. Syme also provides ample excerpts from brilliant past letter writers, Maxwell and Welty among them, and culture hits as inspiration, including Nick Bantock's cult classic 1991 epistolary novel Griffin and Sabine, an extraordinary correspondence. 1991 epistolary novel. For love letters, Syme recommends James Joyce's notes to Nora Barnacle, Absolute Filth, she tells me, or those between Oscar Wilde and Lord Alfred Douglas. There are stories of fan mail success, Prince's adoring missives to Joni Mitchell, George Clooney's to Paul Newman, Zora Neale Hurston's to Langston Hughes, all of which morphed into mutual admiration. When I raise my personal barrier to entry, you can change your handwriting, Syme assures me, and with a new pen in hand, after just a weekend of doodling the quick brown fox and sending tentative missives off by mail, I see that she's right. Six-pack, powerful memoirs of creation and self-examination. Reading the waves, memories are conjurings, writes Lydia Yuknovich in this quicksilver, expansive exploration of grief and hauntings. The deaths of her former husband, mother, daughter, student, sexuality, storytelling, and more, published by Riverhead. Fearless and Free, Josephine Baker's tale of performance and resistance, has been translated from the French into English for the first time by Anam Zafar and Sophie R. Lewis, with an introduction by Ioma Oluo, published by Tiny Reparations. Bibliophobia, Sarah Chiaia unpacks a lifetime of books, including Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye and Helen DeWitt's The Last Samurai, that have illuminated, complicated, and fundamentally shaped her worldview. Published by Random House. Talk to Me. In 1957, Rich Benjamin's charismatic maternal grandfather served as president of Haiti for 19 days before his leadership ended in a violent coup. Through deep research, Benjamin Plum's Secrets, Both Familial and National, published by Pantheon. Wild West Village, in uninhibited essays, country singer and Mozart and the Jungle star Lola Kirk sifts through a Manhattan childhood redolent with Joan Didion and Courtney Love, and a coming of age on screen and through song, published by Simon and Schuster. One day, everyone will have always been against this. From the assault on Gaza to climate change, Egypt-born, U.S.-based Omar El-Akkad reckons with the West, symbol of freedom, longtime aggressor, published by Knopf. Coming Om. Robert Pattinson has been the face of Dior Om for more than a decade. With a brand new fragrance campaign and a leading role in Mickey 17, the actor takes a moment to reflect, by Savannah Walsh. In the photo, Robert Pattinson wears Dior Men by Kim Jones, behind the scenes of the new Dior Om campaign. Robert Pattinson's star is back in orbit, before returning to the big screen this spring in Mickey 17, a sci-fi dark comedy. From Oscar-winning filmmaker Bong Joon-ho, he appears as a sensual everyman in a new Dior Homme campaign. Pattinson rocketed to global fame in the Twilight series, and that vampire vibe, dark, moody, enigmatic, shaped his early days in the spotlight. But when he turns up on Zoom in a Supreme hoodie, his hair standing in all directions, it all seems to rest more lightly on his shoulders. Everyone has some level of imposter syndrome, but for many years, I was very envious of people who I perceived as feeling very comfortable in their own skin, especially when they're performing. Why can't I just feel like that? Maybe it's just a natural gift, and I wish I could be like that, blah, blah, blah. I spent a long time trying to get rid of anxiety, he says, and I guess after many years of doing something, you realize, oh, you can't really get rid of the anxiety, but you can turn it around and use it as energy. My insecurities about everything as a performer became my radar for what to do. After working with Dior for 10-plus years, Pattinson has even grown to embrace being the face of a fragrance. I was very clear about what I wanted to do on the first campaign, because I really knew what I didn't want to do. A looking into the camera, hey, sexy fragrance thing, he says with a laugh. So it has this energy where you're fighting against it. I've kind of settled into it a little bit more, so I guess there's more sensuality. It feels more grown. There's a romanticism to it, which is sort of quite sweet. Dior's latest scent is a reimagining of its original 2005 composition from perfume creation director Francis Kurkdjian, who uses the iris plant from flower to root for a fresh, sultry aroma. There's a closeness to it, Pattinson says. I'm not really that into having a scent where as soon as you walk into a room, everybody's like, oh, you're wearing a fragrance. There's something about this which combines with your natural scent as well. It's not massively obtrusive. It's more of an aura thing. Pattinson himself gets atmospheric, playing a regenerative astronaut in Mickey 17, which debuts later this year after a few failures to launch. I like how much it normalizes space travel, says the actor, who since his last live-action film, Welcome to Child with partner Suki Waterhouse. It reminds me of when all these news stories came basically saying that aliens exist on Earth after years and years and years, and everyone's forgotten. They're on TikTok again 2 seconds later. That's the attitude about space travel, Pattinson continues. It's not like what you see in normal sci-fi movies, where there's a gravitas to it. With Mickey, it's just the same old shit. You've still just got an awful boss. There's no respite on the other side of the universe. It's worse. Given the film's ambivalence about space, it's little surprise that Pattinson has no desire to planet surf. My lack of imagination, he begins, even when you see someone on a space shuttle. Okay, so you go in the space shuttle, and then you just look out windows. How different would it be from watching the TV, watching a screensaver? Other than being able to tell people, I wouldn't mind doing a spacewalk, but being in the ship, I think I prefer to maybe get a dog. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.